Thanks very much. I'm not sure why I'm here because I'm not terribly good at boosterism and marketing. I do have an interest in how cities compete, but you probably noticed that Western Australia is not very good at selling itself. When I come to Queensland, I realise how little we do of it. We, of course, have much higher stats than you do on all of those growth things, but we don't talk about it. In fact, we'd quite happily secede. But the story about our cities is one of becoming more resilient, more smart, and more competitive at the same time. Now, I've just been around looking at American cities and talking to them about this, and I always start off with this slide because in America there's a new book that's come out called The Black Swan, and it's based on the fact that when Vlaming sailed into the Swan River in 1697, he was the first European to have seen a black swan. Up till that time, swans were always white. And in philosophy since then, the idea of the black swan is the unexpected, the unpredictable, that history at up till that point would not have enabled you to predict. So today I want to look at the three black swans of climate change, peak oil and the crash, and how these rather unpredictable things, which perhaps could have been predicted, are now changing our cities. The two books that are taking around resilient cities responding to peak oil and climate change is the main one. But Green Urbanism Down Under I wrote with Tim Beatley. Tim and I are going around Australia in the next few weeks to talk mostly about that book. And I had a look at the index last night, and there are 15 references to Brisbane in there. He spent 6 months in Australia and he came to Brisbane and was totally bowled over by some of the sustainability features here, particularly impressed by a number of Campbell Newman's programs that he writes about. So this is an American book. It's doing very well in America, and it is trying to say that American cities can learn from down under. So that kind of quiet marketing is very good, I believe. Resilient cities is really about adapting to the big issues, not denying them. There are cities that deny change is happening and they suffer. It is about turning challenges into opportunities, and it is about learning from other cities. Jane Jacobs, who writes beautifully about cities, has shown that in history, essentially what happens is that cities copy each other, adapt and innovate on the basis of that, and then that's how they create wealth. The issues that confront us are now very deep, that we are warming the atmosphere, and that this is melting ice caps, that it is causing cities to be threatened, and in Australia the bushfires were extraordinary in terms of what they've done to Melbourne, recognising that climate change impact. But Stern is the one who has shown us that the economy must now adapt, that the cost of action to the global economy would be roughly 1% of GDP, while the cost of inaction from 5 to 20% of GDP. So early action, he talks about, and the idea of coming down this line rather than the others, because this is the only future that really makes a lot of sense. If we don't keep under 450, we are going to have serious problems, and of course the Queensland icons are at stake there. And the Garneau Review here has shown us that the US and Australia have to decline the fastest. We are the ones out there. We are the ones who need that top trajectory of coming down that line, that the EU and Japan, they're starting at a much lower base. China and India are likely to keep growing for a while, but the global trajectory is there, and we can look at that and say, well, this is we have to take the burden more. Why is that? Or we can say, well, we've got an opportunity to get in there and lead. And that's the approach that's taken by a lot of people, including the Natural Edge Project, which is based here in Brisbane. Charlie Hargrove's books, he's now got six of them, are quite remarkable global leaders in showing how to decouple these issues from economic growth. That economic growth does not have to be threatened by it, but can in fact be given a boost because we can decouple these environmental issues from them. The world is now facing this as a reality. With Obama elected with a commitment to 80% reductions by 2050, that's the last part of the climate scepticism gone. Australia joined the world last year. Thank you very much for providing Kevin Rudd. And we are now in a position where the world is facing the Copenhagen round in 2009 to develop a roadmap of how to do this. It's not a question of whether they want to or not. This is it. This is the agenda. So we have a new loss of confidence in the old way. The fossil fuel-based future is gone, and we have to develop another one. The peak oil issue is something that underlies a lot of things at the moment. A practical limit to the number of barrels of crude oil that can be pumped every day is a simple definition of it. Every oil field goes through a production cycle and ends up declining, and the US is now 87% depleted in its oil. It was predicted to peak in 1970. It did. It's been going down ever since. And the guy who predicted it, M. King Hubbert, also predicted in 1971 when the world would peak. I met him in 1973. It certainly changed my life when I realised that the next 30 years were critical to preparing us. It's all of his predictions have come true. Essentially, we are not finding oil like we were. These are all the countries that have been through their peaks, including Australia, and we now face a world. West Australian oil, by the way, is now peaked and is declining at 11% per year. This is the world we are facing. Now, do we get overwhelmed by that? A lot of people do. And when the oil price went berserk last year, it certainly signalled the end of the era of cheap oil, but in fact induced the crash. The subprime mortgage areas that suffered most were the car-dependent areas, where people could no longer afford their mortgages because the price of fuel tripled and they couldn't get anywhere without long drives. That's where it began, and it spread around the world. And essentially now banks are in a situation where they're burnt. They've been bent before by the issues of oil prices rising and then dropping, but now they're broken. So we have little confidence in an oil-based future. However, there is little confidence in oil-based alternatives because the price has dropped so dramatically that all the other options suddenly are off the table, like biofuels and tar sands and things like that. So in the US, they're talking about having a benchmark price for oil of $100 a barrel. Otherwise, they can't get to develop the alternatives. So if you're expecting oil to stay cheap, I wouldn't try. It's going to be a different future. In the US, you can go to whole areas which have been abandoned. These areas are abandoned because they are no longer viable. They had no resilience to the price of oil going up. And they are... It's shameful, I think, that we would build areas like this. So scattered, no services anywhere, no jobs close by, no public transport, and they are places that no one now we'll live in. So economists are now looking at these issues and saying, well, it's a different world. Vehicle miles of travel are declining in the US. They are going down. There is less traffic on the roads now than there was. And it's been happening for 5 years before the fuel price went up. Public transport has been dramatically increasing, went up 6% last year. Containers are going down, aviation's going down. Things that depend on cheap oil are not what they used to be. So where do we now invest? In land development, sprawl's no longer smart. In transport, low-cost oil and cars are no longer smart. In small business, it's a different world. So we have a crash that is changing us dramatically. The old world is dying. Fear abounds. How do we find resilience? In our book, we look at four scenarios. There are people who say, we'll never get out of this. The collapse is just beginning. It's going to get worse and worse. We'll be abandoning cities. There are others who say, all we can do is grow our own food. Or the market solution, eco-enclaves surrounded by Mad Max suburbs. These are options that we reject and say they're all based on fear. There is hope based on a new kind of resilient city. Building a new economy which is more resilient, that recognises black swans do come regularly, that we can create something with new confidence, and that it is based on hope. Charlie Hargraves at the Natural Edge Project has this graph which I find very helpful. The waves of innovation that have changed our cities in the past have all had different black swans. Imagine living in the era of the first wave of industrialism based on water-based transport and iron and mechanisation and textiles, and along comes the railroad. It's like Cranford. It was scary, but it was an extraordinary change, and cities spread out along those railroads with steam power. Then the electricity, what an extraordinary thing that suddenly we'd light up our cities and we could have electric trains and electric trams that changed the nature of our cities. Then the car, which spread our cities out even further and enabled us to, with low-cost fuel, to build a different kind of civilization. Then the digital revolution, and now a sustainability-based one, that we've got radical resource productivity of 80% less greenhouse gas by 2050, whole system design, biomimicry, green chemistry, industrial ecology, renewable energy, green nanotechnology, all appearing, all available, and going to change our cities, making us more resilient, smart, and competitive. Smart because they all depend on that digital revolution. They can't work properly without it, and they build on that. So it's really that whole wave of IT and ET together is what is going to remake our cities. So we look at these kinds of cities that are all part of the emerging new smart city, and some quick images. Adelaide's become a real leader in solar energy. Tim Beatley was bowled over by how much it has changed in 4 or 5 years, with 20% renewables now. They can't fit any more into their system at the moment. Lots of commitment to practical ways of making it a more renewable city. There are new cities emerging like Masdar and Dongtan and so on that are 100% solar and wind. There are all kinds of technologies like geothermal appearing. And the growth in these industries are extraordinary. Around the world, PV solar is growing 40% a year. There are rapid increases in all those businesses associated with these technologies, roof-mounted wind systems. But the big issue of storing renewables is sitting there, and I'll come back to that. Carbon-neutral cities is really about recognising the bioregion and the importance of linking that to the way the city is changing, and in particular in the next 20 to 30 years of building offsets into programs like Gondwana Links. Carbon neutral programs are available. We've got one that is building a whole bioregional link from the coast through to the Kalgoorlie woodlands. Photosynthetic city is something that is emerging as our cities heat up, and as we begin to see that we can build nature into the cities in new ways. This is a wall in Paris that you can't walk past. It's so amazing. And of course, green roofs appearing everywhere. In Chicago, there are now 300 of them, because they had a very bad summer once, and the urban heat island effect, which is getting worse, is growing faster than the atmosphere is warming, is causing a lot of pain. So cooling the city down is one thing that is the objective of the mayor of Chicago. Even Dearborn in Michigan, where the Ford Motor Company is, that have greened their roof and created a biological reserve on their rooftop, as well as having many water and energy benefits. The distributed city, Sydney, is making a big thing about with their green transformers, Dong Tan with their localised energy and water systems, even in redevelopments like Kogarah in Sydney, with its water-sensitive design, its photovoltaics on the roof and so on. The eco-efficient city is one that requires us to build with factor four technologies, and there are now appearing some cities that are doing this, and some developments like eco-villages in this one in Adelaide, where it is considerably less footprint. The place-based cities is something that Tim talks a lot about, and how to build on the identity, the sense of place that is there, and to do it with things like local food, farmers markets, of taking waterways and turning them back into creeks that are both good for people, good for the ecology, and still work as stormwater. Imagine being the mayor of Seoul, elected on the basis that you were going to take down that freeway because underneath it is a river. It was a sacred river. It was a critical part of their culture. And he did it and created this 6 kilometre long central park, which is now an extraordinary feature in Seoul that brings people from all over the world to look at. The traffic disappeared, and the mayor of Seoul is now the president of Korea. Doesn't hurt the politics. The sustainable transport city is my thing, I suppose, is one of stopping certain things and starting others. The obsession we've had with 50 years of growth that we must provide extra urban road capacity and that we can allow urban scatter to occur is something that has to change. It is going to be a while setting in, but it is definitely a way to save money, as well as to not continue the old economy. It is, however, we do need to build the green economy. We need to build electric, renewable transport cities with much greater localism in the economy and infrastructure, and that will require money. But money is around. This is the Katy Freeway in Houston, which I went on a few months ago. Notice the lone star on every pillar. It costs $100 million a mile. It is probably the last urban freeway to be built in the US. Los Angeles stopped building freeways in their city 20 years ago, and they are now recognising that it doesn't work. This is 20 lanes wide in places and still fills every day, because 20 lanes of traffic could be replaced by one railway line. And the effect on cities has never been shown to have any great economic benefit. The delay versus freeway miles graph is completely chaotic. There is no relationship. There should be. Freeway miles should reduce delay, shouldn't it? But it doesn't. And what we see now is that if you replaced that many cars with three buses or one light rail, you create enormous space in the city. Space is money, space is opportunities for doing livable, clever things. It certainly reduces greenhouse as well. So these 500 buses that are committed to can be seen in terms of an extraordinary opportunity to help create extra space in the city. With PB, in the last year, we did a detailed study of what it actually costs to develop on the fringe compared to redevelopment. I know there are problems with redevelopment, political problems, requires more change than just digging up a bit of greenfield. But in fact, we heavily subsidise greenfield development, around $85,000 per block across Australia. And it costs $250,000 extra per block over 50 years for transport. And it produces 4.4 tonnes per year more in greenhouse gases with all kinds of health issues. That paper is on our website. We've recently produced the data on density in Australian cities, looking at the changes. Sydney and Melbourne are now growing back in at a faster rate than they're going out. There is still some suburbs on the fringe being built, but they are mostly coming back. Brisbane, slightly, but coming. It is the most sprawled area in Australia, even more so than Perth and Adelaide. But we're similar cities. We haven't quite yet reached that that block of the large distances that are so far away that people are coming back in large droves. You have a plan. It's a very good plan, and it is one that has now shown where to stop the scatter and where to concentrate and focus. It is a very important part of what you do to make your region and your city resilient, smart and competitive. Transport is a critical part of that, and somehow or other in the last 20 years I'm still a little shocked by how it's happened. We have rebuilt our rail system without a cent of federal money, and that has happened because of political intervention, and it was very popular. We had 90% approval ratings on this southern railway, which has just been opened. It carries now 55,000 passengers a day. It was predicted to carry 30, and it replaced the 14,000 who were carried on the buses down that corridor. And this is in an area that didn't deserve a railway. Now, I've been dealing with the politics of railways for some time, and it's quite hard to get through to certain engineers that that railways can work in scattered low density areas, and they must. And this has been dramatically successful. It actually goes 80 kilometres to the southern suburbs that in American cities, for example, you would never have considered a railway going. They are rebuilding rail, but they're doing it in their inner city areas rather than out further, and that's where we need to go. It is a fast, convenient, very good electric option, and it is beginning to reclaim some of that freeway space. Similarly in Phoenix, which probably is the city with the least public transport in the world, and they have taken out a lane of traffic and put in this new light rail system. These cities are also recognising the value of TODs, transit-oriented developments, which are built around stations. This is Chatswood, which was built using a PPP. Now, we've tended to think PPPs are public-private partnerships, are all about toll roads, but this was done with a partnership on land development. And land development can be smart by redeveloping on the top of and around rail stations like this at Chatswood. You see the surrounding suburbs here. they're still the low-density Australian suburbia that everybody loves. But nearby is a small city now, where their kids can get jobs, where they can go and shop, where there are services, and where there's a good public transport service. So that's how we rebuild our suburbs. We don't have to fill in every backyard. We need to be much cleverer. We need to focus it. And we need to do it with the private sector, because they will help fund that. So transit-oriented development is a big opportunity, and it will significantly reduce the amount of car use in our cities. In fact, people living in TODs use cars 50% less. They usually have a car, but there's one less per household, and that means they save 20% of their household income. Where do they spend that? If they're not buying a car, which doesn't do a lot for their local economy, they spend it locally, spend it in the city. So it's an economic development mechanism. TODs are smart. And light rail is certainly on the agenda and will be a key part of your region as we develop the Gold Coast Light Rail, which I'm sure will happen. Electric vehicles are also on the agenda. I'm not so anti-car that I can't see that they will be part of our future, and they will be, however, electric. They will be plug-in electric, and they are on the market from this year. And most manufacturers are now going to release them. Why is this happening? Not just because they don't need oil to push them, but because they are going to be part of the electric utility system. The storage devices that are part of it, it's called V2G, vehicle to grid, and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles with a smart grid is the new agenda. It is happening right across America. $30 billion they're putting into it there. And you have a better place here in Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney with a similar objective. It works like this. You plug in a knife, you fill up for a dollar. It's cheap overnight. And then during the day you go in your car to where you need to go and you plug in. And the rest of the day when it's just sitting there, it becomes part of the electric system, because it is feeding back when the peak begins. And the utility will pay you for having your vehicle plugged in. And you can only do that if you've got a smart grid, you've got broadband, you've got all the control systems. It's definitely happening, but it is happening only in cities that are ready for it. And lithium-ion batteries are the black swan that is making this happen. They are brilliant. So they can be in your buses, electric buses, they can be in cars and scooters and motorbikes. So we can now make a 100% renewable city. Adelaide reached 20%, they couldn't do any more. They can now go more because it can be stored in the batteries. It's a two-way flow. So Israel's going down this track, they'll be the first. Denmark is going to 40% renewables, and Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne are going to be leaders in this if you give them the chance. You'll need to build the plug-in infrastructure. It's not much. It's not like building hydrogen or something. But this will be the next phase of the smart city. We've got a development, $16 billion development, 10,000 dwellings, which will be 100% carbon free. It will be based on this technology, and it is going to demonstrate how to do it. Are there any places that are doing all of these things? Vauban's the only place in the world I know, in Freiburg. It's an extraordinary place. It exports renewable energy from its grid based on the office block, which is filled out with PVs. It's got a light rail and it's got lots of bikes, and it's got a solar garage where you park the car, and only half the households have one because they don't really need it. There's bikes everywhere. Because they have so much more space that you don't need to have for bitumen, they have lots of bush and lots of space for kids to play and grow food and mums to wander around, and the kids are feral. They are free because it is not full of traffic. It is a place that you can imagine being very attractive to live, and young families love to go there. So it is resilient and sustainable and solar, There's thousands of people go there every day to look at it. But I believe that it can show that our cities can be better, significantly less in footprint, but a place that people would want to be living in. I want to finish by just talking about this Global Green New Deal, which is the UNEP, United Nations approach to how we deal with the crash. Green growth, green economy, clean tech. America has now set the scene for this. Their stimulus package has $100 billion in it for green growth. They want to create 2 million jobs in 2 years. They say for each dollar invested, 45 cents is saved because it is saving fuel. And there is a 20% higher job return than in the old economy, saving massive amount of greenhouse gas. It is based on smart grids, electric rail, renewables, energy efficiency, and it has taken away some of the old chestnuts. They've got examples like Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, which is going to be a model, a bit like our Northport Key. The governor is driving this agenda. Chicago says they're going to be the green city that leads the way. New York says, no, we are. We're the green building city. We're going to reduce greenhouse 30% by 2030. And then the mayor of Los Angeles says, no, we are going to be the greenest big city in America. This competition is good. This is the new competition. And of course, Seattle says, no, we are by far the best. We even have eco-friendly stripping. I don't know what that means. Barack Obama said finding the new driver of our economy is going to be critical. There is no better potential driver that pervades all aspects of our economy than a new energy economy. That's the number one priority. It's a new world when you start to hear that. Europe is further down this track, and they've announced 105 billion euro for green jobs. It's a third of their budget. And they are especially trying to get eco-innovation in small and medium enterprises. The UK also going down this dramatically, and many examples of it, Bedsead and places like that. In Asia, Korea, this president I mentioned, is creating 960,000 jobs over 4 years, 3% of their GNP putting into this. China, $586 billion in their stimulus package. What have we done? We've got a $6 billion energy efficiency package. We've got $6 billion Green Car Innovation Fund, which is unfortunately not very green and not very innovative because it will not allow plug-in electric vehicles. It has missed the boat on that one, and it ought to change. They've announced $40 million on bike tracks. It's the biggest bicycle push for a long time. $350 million on grassroots job creation, $500 million on the buyback for the Murray-Darling, $400 million for local water conservation, stormwater harvesting. These are actually comparable figures to almost any other country in terms of green growth opportunities. We've still got our Infrastructure Australia package to come. It'll be there shortly. And the renewables package is still to come as well. There's no estimate of green jobs in that. I don't think they've quite taken it on because it was a bit of a mixture of Xenophon and the Greens as well in there. But CSIRO have estimated we could create 2.5 to 3 million jobs over 20 years. And there are plenty of examples of how this is happening in our buildings, like CH2. and it is a matter of having an integrated package of infrastructure, the stimulus package and a carbon trading package that will need to help us into this brave new world. Thank you very much.